Miramax Films. Ealing Studios, 1902 to 2002. Miramax Films and Ealing Studios present, in association with Film Council and New Market Capital Group, A Fragile Film. A well-dressed man is chased through the street by some bobbies. Starring Rupert Everett, Colin Firth, Frances O'Connor, Reese Witherspoon and Judi Dench. The man climbs up onto a window ledge and the police go racing past. He drops down, but the police spot him and once again are hot on his heels.
You won't get away, sir.
Time to pay your debt.
Hey!
He jumps onto the side of a passing carriage. The woman on board shrieks and he coolly offers her a cigarette from his case. He grins at her, then jumps down from the carriage, whilst the woman swoons as she smokes on the cigarette. Now, the man is in a grand home, playing the piano. The importance of being earnest. The butler is clearing plates away.
Did you hear what I was playing, Lane?
I didn't think it polite to listen, sir.
I'm sorry for that, for your sake. I don't play accurately. Anyone can play accurately. But I play with wonderful expression.
Yes, sir.
Bills, bills, bills. All I ever get is bills.
And then there's the matter of my unpaid wages, sir.
On a country estate.
Yet again, the wastrel habits of my brother Ernest turn me from my duties here.
Yes, sir.
Terrible nuisance, but there's nothing to be done. We'll return Monday afternoon.
Yes, sir.
The man waves at a young, blonde-haired woman.
Pay particular attention, if you will, Miss Prism, to her German grammar.
Yes, Mr. Worthing.
Worthing climbs into a carriage.
I suppose you found my cigarette case, have you, Merriman?
We're still looking, sir.
Hey, walk up!
Later, Worthing's on board a train. In his compartment, he opens his suitcase, then looks at his reflection in the mirror. In London, thick smoke pours from chimneys, whilst a street bustles with horses, people and carriages. Worthing, wearing suit, hat and scarf, weaves his way through the mass of people. In a music hall, dancing girls are on stage. Worthing's in the audience, keeping an eye on an attractive woman serving drinks.
Excuse me,
the man who was running from the police is also in the audience. Worthing goes over to him.
Ernest. Algie!
How are you, my dear Ernest? What brings you up to town?
Oh, pleasure. What else would bring one anywhere?
Where have you been since last Thursday?
In the country.
You're always in the country. What on earth do you do there?
Well, when one is in town, one amuses oneself. When one is in the country, one amuses other people. It's excessively boring.
Who are these people you amuse?
Oh, neighbours.
Nice neighbours in your part of Shropshire. Oh,
perfectly horrid. Never speak to one of them.
How immensely you must amuse them. By the way, Shropshire is your county, is it not?
What?
Shropshire?
Oh, yes, of course. Say, dear boy, what plans have you got for tea tomorrow?
You know perfectly well that Aunt Augusta is coming to tea tomorrow.
Aunt Augusta?
Yes, Aunt Augusta and Gwendolyn.
Are perfectly delightful. Perhaps I might and pay my respects.
Yes, that is all very well, but I'm afraid Aunt Augusta won't approve of your being there.
Why do you say that?
My dear fellow, the way that you flirt with Gwendolyn is perfectly disgraceful. It's almost as bad as the way Gwendolyn flirts with you.
I am in love with Gwendolyn.
Ah.
And I have come up to town expressly to propose to her.
Well, I thought you'd come up for pleasure. I call that business.
Of how utterly unromantic you are.
I really don't see what there is romantic about proposing. Why, one may be accepted. One usually is, I believe. And then, the excitement is over. No, the very essence of romance is uncertainty.
25 black.
At a casino.
Anyway, I certainly can't see you and Gwendolyn being married.
Why on earth do you say that?
Well, in the first place, I don't give my consent.
Your consent?
My dear fellow, Gwendolyn is my cousin. And before I allow you to marry her, you shall have to clear up this whole question of Cecily.
Cecily? Mm. What on earth do you mean? What do you mean, Algy, by Cecily? I don't know anyone by the name of Cecily. Mm-hmm. Do you mean to say you have had my cigarette case all this time? Mm. I wish to goodness you had let me know. I've been writing frantic letters to Scotland Yard about it. I was very nearly offering a very large reward.
I wish you would offer one. I happen to be more than usually hard up. Oh. Well, it makes no matter, for I see now the thing isn't yours after all.
Well, of course it's mine. You've seen me with it 100 times.
Not according to the inscription.
And you have no right whatsoever to read what is written inside. It is a very ungentlemanly thing to read a private cigarette case.
Yes, but this isn't your cigarette case. This cigarette case is a present from someone of the name of Cecily, and you said you didn't know anyone of that name.
Well, if you want to know, Cecily happens to be my aunt.
Your aunt?
Yes, charming old lady she is too. Lives at Tunbridge Wells. Just give it back to me, Algy.
Yes, but why does your aunt call you her uncle?
Algy sits next to Worthing.
From little Cecily with her fondest love to her dear Uncle Jack. Mm. There is no objection, I admit, to an aunt being a small aunt. But why an aunt, no matter what her size may be, should call her own nephew her uncle, I can't quite make out. Besides, your name isn't Jack at all. It's Ernest.
It isn't Ernest. It's Jack.
What? You've always told me it was Ernest. I've introduced you to everyone as Ernest. It is perfectly absurd you're saying your name isn't Ernest. It's on your cards. Here is one of them. Mr. Ernest Worthing, B4 the Albany.
Well, it is Ernest in town and Jack in the country. And the cigarette case was given to me in the country. So I've always pretended to have a younger brother.
Ah, of the name of Ernest. And little Cecily.
My ward, Miss Cecily Cardew.
See you tomorrow.
Mm. Where is that place in the country, by the way?
That is nothing to you, dear boy. You are certainly not going to be invited. I may tell you candidly, the place is not in Shropshire.
Oh, I suspected that, my dear fellow. Just as I suspected you to be a Bunburyist. Indeed, you are one of the most advanced Bunburyists I know. See you five.
Algy runs off.
Cecily, your German grammar is on the table. Pray, open it at page 15. We will repeat yesterday's lesson.
But I don't like German. It isn't at all a becoming language. I know perfectly well I look quite plain after my German lesson.
Child, you know how anxious your guardian is that you should improve yourself in every way.
Dear Uncle Jack is so very serious. Sometimes I think he is so serious he cannot be quite well.
Cecily, I'm surprised at you. Mr. Worthing has many troubles in his life. You must remember his constant anxiety about that unfortunate young man, his brother.
I wish Uncle Jack would allow that unfortunate young man, his brother, to come down here sometimes. We might have a good influence over him, Miss Prism.
I'm not sure that I would desire to reclaim him. I'm not in favour of this modern mania for turning bad people into good people at a moment's notice.
Cecily imagines a knight coming to rescue her.
Cecily? To your work, child.
Worthing to Algy.
Bunburyist. On earth do you mean, Bunburyist?
You have invented a very useful younger brother called Ernest, in order that you may be able to come up to town as often as you'd like. I have invented an invaluable, permanent invalid called Bunbury, in order that I may be able to go down to the country as often as I choose. If it wasn't for Bunbury's extraordinary bad health, for instance, I wouldn't be able to dine with you at the Savoy tonight, for I've really had an appointment with Aunt Augusta for more than a week.
I haven't asked you to dine with me anyway tonight.
I know. You're absurdly careless about giving out invitations. Don't touch the cucumber sandwiches. They're ordered specially for Aunt Augusta.
Well, you've been eating them all the time.
Well, that's quite a different matter. She's my aunt. It must be her. Only relatives or creditors ever ring in that Wagnerian manner. Now, if I manage to get her out of the way for 10 minutes so that you may have an opportunity for proposing to Gwendolyn, may I dine with you at the Savoy tonight?
Worthing nods, and Algy goes to the door. Worthing checks his appearance in the mirror.
Lady Bracknell and Miss Fairfax.
Good afternoon, dear Algy. I hope you are behaving very well.
Well, I'm feeling very well, Aunt Augusta.
That's not quite the same thing. In fact, two things rarely go together.
Lady Bracknell, I...
Oh, goodness, you are smart.
Oh, I'm always smart. Am I not, Mr. Worthing?
You are quite perfect, Miss Fairfax.
Oh, I hope I am not that. It would leave no room for development. And I intend to develop in many directions.
Ooh. I'm sorry if we're a little late, Algy. I was obliged to call on dear Lady Harbury. I've not been there since her poor husband's death. I never saw a woman so altered. She looks quite 20 years younger. And now I'll have a cup of tea and one of those nice cucumber sandwiches you promised me.
Certainly, Aunt Augusta.
Won't you sit here, Gwendolyn?
Thanks, Mama. I'm quite comfortable where I am.
Good heavens, Lane, why are there no cucumber sandwiches?
There were no cucumbers in the market this morning, sir. I went down twice.
Oh, no cucumbers?
No, sir, not even for ready money.
That will do, Lane.
Thank you, sir.
Algy slams the plate down in frustration, then sits down next to Lady Bracknell.
I'm greatly distressed, Aunt Augusta, about there being no cucumbers, not even for ready money.
It really makes no matter, Algy. I had some crumpets with Lady Harbury. I've got quite a treat for you tonight, Algy. I'm going to send you down with Mary Farker. She is such a nice woman.
Aunt Augusta, I shall have to give up the pleasure of dining with you tonight.
I hope not, Algy. It will put my table completely out.
Oh, it is a great bore, and I need hardly say a terrible disappointment to me, but I've just had a telegram to say that my poor friend Bunbury is very ill again. They seem to think I should be with him.
Very strange. This Mr. Bunbury seems to suffer from curiously bad health.
Oh, yes, poor Bunbury is a dreadful invalid.
Well, I must say, Algy, I think it is high time Mr. Bunbury made up his mind whether he was going to live or die. The shilly-shallying with the question is absurd. I should be much obliged if you would ask Mr. Bunbury from me to be kind enough not to have a relapse next Saturday. It is my last reception, and I rely on you to arrange my music for me.
I'll speak to Bunbury, Aunt Augusta, if he's still conscious. And now, if you'll follow me into the next room, I'll run over the musical programme I've already drawn up for the occasion.
Thank you, Algy. It is very thoughtful of you. Gwendolyn, you will accompany me?
Certainly, Mama.
Gwendolyn rolls her eyes, but goes begrudgingly.
Charming day it has been, Miss Fairfax.
Pray don't talk to me about the weather, Mr. Worthing. Whenever people talk to me about the weather, I always feel quite certain that they mean something else. And that makes me so nervous.
I do mean something else.
I thought so.
And I would like to take advantage of Lady Bracknell's temporary absence.
I would certainly advise you to do so. Mama has a way of coming back suddenly into a room that I've often had to speak to her about.
Miss Fairfax, ever since I met you, I have admired you more than any girl I've ever met since I met you.
Yes, I'm quite aware of the fact, and I often wish that in public, at any rate, you'd been more demonstrative. For me, you have always had an irresistible fascination.
Gwendolyn.
Even before I met you, I was far from indifferent to you. We live, as I hope you know, Mr. Worthing, in an age of ideals. And my ideal has always been to love someone of the name of Ernest. There's something in that name that inspires absolute confidence. The moment Algy first mentioned to me that he had a friend called Ernest, I knew I was destined to love you.
You really love me, Gwendolyn?
Passionately.
Oh, darling, you don't know how happy you've made me.
My own Ernest.
You don't mean to say, though, do you, that you couldn't love me if my name wasn't Ernest?
But your name is Ernest.
Yes, I know it is, but supposing it was something else.
Ah, well, that is clearly a metaphysical speculation. And like most metaphysical speculation, has very little reference at all to the actual facts of real life as we know them.
Personally, darling, to speak quite candidly, I don't much care about the name of Ernest. I don't think it suits me at all.
It suits you perfectly. It is a divine name. It has a music of its own. It produces vibrations.
Not really, Gwendolyn. I must say, I think there are lots of other much nicer names. I think... Jack, for instance. A charming name.
Jack? I've known several Jacks, and they all, without exception, are more than usually plain. The only really safe name is Ernest.
Gwendolyn, oh. We must get married at once.
Married, Mr. Worthing?
Well, Shirley, you know that I love you, and you led me to believe, Miss Fairfax, that you were not absolutely indifferent to me.
I adore you. But you haven't proposed to me yet. Nothing's been said at all about marriage. The subject has not even been touched on.
Algy peers back at his friend. Worthing gets down on one knee in front of Gwendolyn.
Gwendolyn. Yes, Mr. Worthing, what have you to say to me?
You know what I have to say to you.
Yes, but you don't say it.
Gwendolyn, will you marry me?
Mr. Worthing, rise, sir, from this semi-recumbent posture. It is most indecorous.
Mama, I must beg you to retire. Mr. Worthing has not quite finished yet.
Finished what, may I ask?
I am engaged to be married to Mr. Worthing, Mama.
Pardon me, Gwendolyn, you are not engaged to anyone. When you do become engaged to someone, I or your father, should his health permit him, will inform you of the fact. You will wait for me below in the carriage.
Mama.
In the carriage, Gwendolyn.
Gwendolyn looks at Worthing desperately as she picks up her fur and parasol.
Gwendolyn, the carriage.
Gwendolyn goes, and Lady Bracknell looks steadfastly at Worthing.
I feel bound to tell you, Mr. Worthing, you are not down on my list of eligible young men. However, I am quite ready to enter your name as a possible candidate. Perhaps you would attend a meeting at my house at 11 o'clock tomorrow morning. I shall have a few questions to put to you. Algernon?
So, did you tell Gwendolyn the truth about being Ernest in town and Jack in the country?
My dear fellow, the truth isn't quite the sort of thing one tells to a nice, sweet, refined girl. What extraordinary ideas you have about the way to behave to a woman.
The only way to behave to a woman is to make love to her if she's pretty and to someone else if she's plain.
That is nonsense. You never talk anything but nonsense.
Well, nobody ever does. Oh, my dear fellow, you've forgotten to pay the bill.
Not at all. I make it a point never to pay at the Savoy.
Why on earth not? You have heaps of money.
Yes, but Ernest hasn't. He's got quite a reputation to keep up.
A waiter watches them go. Meanwhile, Cecily is still indulging her fantasy of a knight in shining armour rescuing her.
Cecily? Your intellectual pleasures await you, my child. You should put away your diary, Cecily. I really don't see why you should keep a diary at all.
I keep a diary in order to enter the wonderful secrets of my life. If I didn't write them down, I should probably forget all about them.
Memory, my dear Cecily, is the diary that we all carry about with us.
I believe memory is responsible for nearly all these three-volume novels people write nowadays.
Do not speak slightingly of the three-volume novel, Cecily. I wrote one myself in earlier days.
Did you really, Miss Prism? I hope it did not end happily.
The good ended happily, and the bad unhappily. That is what fiction means. To your work, child. These speculations are profitless.
But I see dear Dr. Chasuble coming through the garden.
Oh, Dr. Chasuble. This is indeed a pleasure.
And how are we today? Miss Prism, you are, I trust, well.
Miss Prism has just been complaining of a slight headache. I think it would do her so much good to have a short stroll with you in the park, Dr. Chasuble.
Cecily, I have not mentioned anything about a headache.
No, dear Miss Prism, I know that. But I felt instinctively that you had a headache. Indeed, I was thinking about that, not my German lesson, when the rector came along.
I hope, Cecily, you are not inattentive.
Oh, I'm afraid I am.
That's strange. Were I fortunate enough to be Miss Prism's pupil, I would hang upon her lips.
Miss Prism looks at the doctor with a startled expression.
I spoke metaphorically. My metaphor was drawn from bees.
Oh.
I shall see you both, no doubt, at Evensong.
Back in London, Worthing negotiates a busy street that's bustling with horses and carriages. Having crossed it, he makes his way into a grand, opulent house. In the sprawling hallway, massive paintings dominate the far wall. A man on his way out passes Worthing.
Good luck, sir.
Led by a servant, Worthing heads up the stairs. Gwendolyn blows him a kiss from a balcony.
Ernest.
This was her.
A photographer snaps several shots of Worthing, and then a line of servants open all the doors along a corridor at the same time. He's led through to a room where Lady Bracknell is waiting. The chairs are set out as if for an interview.
You can take a seat, Mr. Worthing.
Thank you, Lady Bracknell. I prefer standing.
Lady Bracknell picks up a pen and a notepad.
Do you smoke?
Two other ladies on the judging panel look up at him.
Well, yes, I must admit I smoke.
I'm glad to hear it. A man should always have an occupation of some kind. There are far too many idle men in London as it is. How old are you?
35.
A very good age to be married at. I've always been of opinion that a man who desires to get married should know either everything or nothing. Which do you know?
I know nothing, Lady Bracknell.
I'm pleased to hear it. I do not approve of anything that tampers with natural ignorance. Ignorance is like a delicate, exotic fruit. Touch it, and the bloom is gone. The whole theory of modern education is radically unsound. Fortunately, in England at any rate, education produces no effect whatsoever. If it did, it would prove a serious danger to the upper classes and probably lead to acts of violence in Grosvenor Square. What is your income?
Between 7,000 and 8,000 a year.
In land or in investments?
In investments, chiefly.
That is satisfactory.
I have a country house with some land, of course, attached to it. About 1,500 acres, I believe.
You have a townhouse, I hope. A girl with a simple, unspoilt nature like Gwendolyn could hardly be expected to reside in the country.
Well, of course, I also own a house in Belgrave Square.
Number?
149.
The unfashionable side. I thought there was something.
She reaches for her bell, then has a change of heart.
However, that could easily be altered.
You mean the fashion or the side?
Well, both if necessary, I presume. Are your parents living?
I have lost both my parents.
To lose one parent, Mr. Worthing, may be regarded as a misfortune. To lose both looks like carelessness. Who was your father? He was evidently a man of some wealth.
I'm afraid I really don't know. The fact is, Lady Bracknell, I said I had lost my parents. It would be nearer the truth to say my parents seem to have lost me. I actually don't know who I am by birth. I was... I was found.
Found?
The late Mr. Thomas Cardew, an old gentleman of a very charitable and kindly disposition, found me and gave me the name of Worthing because he happened to have a first-class ticket for Worthing in his pocket at the time. Worthing is a place in Sussex. It is a seaside resort.
And where did this charitable gentleman or the first-class ticket for the seaside resort find you?
In a handbag. Yes, Lady Bracknell, I was in a handbag. Somewhat large, black, white, leather handbag with handles to it. An ordinary handbag, in fact.
In what locality did this Mr. James or Thomas Cardew come across this ordinary handbag?
In the cloakroom at Victoria Station. It was given him in mistake for his own.
The cloakroom at Victoria Station?
Yes, the Brighton line.
The line is immaterial. Mr. Worthing, I confess I am somewhat bewildered by what you have just told me. To be born, or at any rate bred in a handbag, whether it has handles or not, seems to me to display a contempt for the ordinary decencies of family life, which remind one of the worst excesses of the French Revolution. And I presume you know what that unfortunate movement led to.
May I ask you then what you would advise me to do? I need hardly say I would do anything in the world to ensure Gwendolyn's happiness.
I would strongly advise you, Mr. Worthing, to try and acquire some relations as soon as possible, and to make a definite effort to produce, at any rate, one parent of either sex before the season is quite over.
Well, I don't see how I could possibly manage to do that. I can produce the handbag at any moment. It's in my storeroom at home. I really think that should satisfy you, Lady Bracknell.
Me, sir? What is it to do with me? You can hardly imagine that I and Lord Bracknell would dream of allowing our only daughter, a girl brought up with the utmost care, to marry into a cloakroom and form an alliance with a parcel.
Servants open the door.
Good morning, Mr. Worthing.
Good morning.
Later, Worthing's in a public house.
You don't think there's any chance of Gwendolyn becoming like her mother in about 150 years, do you, Alvin?
My dear fellow, all women become like their mothers. That is their tragedy. No man does, and that's his.
Is that clever?
Well, it's perfectly phrased and about as true as any observation in civilized life should be.
Ernest.
Gwendolyn!
Ernest, my dear Ernest.
Good heavens.
Algy, please, I have something very particular to say to Mr. Worthing.
My own darling.
Ernest, the story of your romantic origin, as related to me by Mama, with unpleasing comments, has naturally stirred the deeper fibres of my nature. I followed you here to reassure you that there is nothing that she can possibly do can alter my eternal devotion to you.
Dear Gwendolyn.
Your town address at the Albany I have. What is your address in the country?
The Manor, Woolton, Hertfordshire.
I will communicate with you daily.
My own one.
Oh. Algy has made a note of the address.
Yes, I must confess, I do smoke. I know nothing of Lady Bracknell.
Now Worthing's looking through the missing persons section in a large book.
Produce the handbag at a moment's notice.
Shh! Before you can be found in a handbag at a railway station, someone must have lost you in a handbag at a railway station, do you see?
The librarian nods and Worthing continues his search.
In the first place, what would Lady Bracknell sniffing about? Dear dissolute Ernest is a risk I can no longer afford. And secondly, Cecily is becoming a little too much interested in him. It's rather a bore.
I'd rather like to meet Cecily.
I shall take very good care. You never do. She is excessively pretty and only just 18. No, I'll say he died in Paris of apoplexy.
But it's hereditary, my dear fellow. It's a sort of thing that runs in families. You must better say it was a severe chill.
Very well, then. Poor brother Ernest is carried off suddenly in Paris by a severe chill. That gets rid of him.
Have you told Gwendolyn that you have an excessively pretty ward who's only just 18?
Oh, one doesn't blurt these things out to people. Cecily and Gwendolyn are perfectly certain to become extremely great friends. I bet you anything you like, half an hour after they've met, they will be calling each other sister.
Women only do that when they've called each other a lot of other things first.
Algy has pocketed a handkerchief of Worthing's with the initials EW embroidered on it. Later, he's strolling back to his house when he spots two shadowy figures lurking outside. He climbs in through a downstairs window where the servants are playing music together. He casually tosses his hat into the mouth of the tuba.
Don't let me disturb you.
I hope tomorrow will be a fine day, Lane.
It never is, sir.
You are a perfect pessimist.
I do my best to give satisfaction, sir.
Lane removes Algy's jacket.
You can put out my dress clothes, my smoking jacket, and even bring on the curling tongs.
Yes, sir.
Tomorrow, Lane, I'm going bumbering.
Yes, sir.
Now, Algy's in a hot air balloon. They drift towards Worthing's country estate. Cecily watches the balloon through a telescope. Algy's luggage is lowered down with a rope and lands with a bump on the ground. Merriman hands Cecily a telegram, and as she reads it, she imagines a knight riding towards her.
Ask Mr. Ernest Worthing to come here.
Yes, miss.
Algy strides along by the river, wearing riding boots and a long brown overcoat. Cecily watches him from up a tree.
You are my little cousin Cecily, I'm sure.
You are under some strange mistake. I'm not little. In fact, I believe I'm more than usually tall for my age. But I am your cousin Cecily. And you? You, I see from your card, are Uncle Jack's brother, my cousin Ernest. My wicked cousin Ernest.
I'm not really wicked at all, cousin Cecily. You mustn't think that I'm wicked.
Well, if you are not, then you've certainly been deceiving us all in a very inexcusable manner.
Well, I have been rather reckless.
I'm glad to hear it.
In fact, now that you mention the subject, I have been very bad in my own small way.
Well, I don't think you should be so proud of that, though I am sure it must have been very pleasant.
It's much pleasanter being here with you.
I can't understand how you're here at all. Uncle Jack won't be back till Monday afternoon.
Oh, that is a great disappointment. I'm obliged to go out by the first train on Monday morning. I have a business appointment that I'm anxious to miss.
That's all very well, but still I think you had better wait until Uncle Jack arrives. I know he wants to speak to you about your immigrating.
About my what?
Uncle Jack is sending you to Australia.
Australia? I'd sooner die.
Well, he said at dinner on Wednesday night that you would have to choose between this world, the next world, and Australia.
Oh, well. The accounts I've received of Australia and the next world are not particularly encouraging, Cousin Cecily. This world is good enough for me.
Yes, but are you good enough for it?
No, I'm afraid not. That is why I want you to reform me. You might make that your mission if you don't mind, Cousin Cecily.
I'm afraid I have no time this afternoon.
Well, would you mind me reforming myself this afternoon?
It is rather quixotic of you, but I think you should try.
I will. I feel better already.
You're looking a little worse.
Well, that's because I'm hungry.
Miss Prism and the doctor hurry over to Worthing, who's just arrived wearing morning clothes.
Mr. Worthing!
Worthing!
This is indeed a surprise. We did not look for you till Monday afternoon.
I have returned sooner than I expected.
Dear Mr. Worthing, I trust this garb of woe does not betoken some terrible calamity.
My brother.
More shameful debts and extravagance.
Still leading a life of pleasure.
Dead.
He reveals an urn.
Your brother Ernest is dead.
Quite dead.
What a lesson for him. I trust he will profit by it.
He had many faults, but it is a sad, sad blow.
Yes, indeed, sad. You with him? The end.
No, he died abroad. In Paris, in fact. I had a telegram last night from the
manager of the Grand Hotel.
Is the cause of death mentioned?
Severe chill, it seems.
As a man sows, so shall he reap.
Oh, charity, Miss Prism, charity. I myself am peculiarly susceptible to trouble.
Worthing takes the urn before the doctor sneezes.
Bless you. Uncle Jack, I'm so pleased to see you back. What is the matter, Uncle Jack? Do look happy. You look as if you had toothache, and I have such a surprise for you. Who do you think is in the Rose Garden? Your brother.
Who?
Your brother Ernest. He arrived about half an hour ago.
Oh, nonsense, I haven't got a brother. I mean...
Come, he'll be so pleased to see you've returned so soon.
These are joyful tidings.
Worthing, the doctor, Miss Prism and the servants all make their way through the grounds. Algy is sitting on the veranda enjoying a meal.
Good heavens.
Clocking Worthing's urn and clothes, he spits out some food in surprise. He steps towards him, his head bowed.
Brother John, I've come down from town to tell you that I'm very sorry for all the trouble I've given you, and that I fully intend to lead a better life in the future.
His face expressionless, Worthing hands Algy a piece of paper.
What can I say? The old Ernest is dead, long live the new Ernest. I thought you'd like my little joke.
Little joke.
Knowing me as you do, Brother John, I'm surprised you took it so seriously. At any rate, I stand before you now an entirely new man, risen, as it were, like a phoenix from the ashes.
Uncle Jack, you're not going to refuse your own brother's hand.
Nothing would induce me to take his hand. I think his behaviour utterly disgraceful. He knows perfectly well why.
Do shake his hand, Uncle Jack.
After all, it could be worse. Be dead in Paris.
You could indeed.
Of a severe chill. Achoo.
They shake hands and embrace.
Excuse me, sir. We are putting Mr. Ernest Thames in the blue room on the second
very
floor.
Very nice, Doctor. Do tell me when it's confession.
What? Mr. Ernest's luggage, sir. We're taking it up to the blue.
His luggage?
Yes, sir. Two portmanteaus, two dressing cases, two hat boxes, and a large luncheon basket.
I feel I can only stay a week this time.
You scoundrel, Algy. What have you to say for yourself?
What I have to say, Uncle Jack, is that little Cecily is a darling.
You are not to talk of Miss Cardew like that.
I don't like it.
Your vanity is ridiculous. Your conduct an outrage and your presence in my house utterly absurd.
However, you have got to catch the 4:05 train. I hope you have a pleasant journey back to town.
This bunburying, as you call it, has not been a great success for you.
Algy blows his nose with the embroidered handkerchief. Worthing sees it and starts throttling his friend. Cecily, the doctor, and Miss Prism look over, and Worthing pretends he's embracing Algy.
It's pleasant, is it not, to see so perfect a reconciliation?
I think it's been a great success.
Later, Algy is sitting next to Cecily as she plays the piano. When she stops, he takes over. He squints his eyes, trying to read the music. Miss Prism looks over disdainfully. She sways her head to the new ditty. Algy looks at Cecily, brushing against her as he reaches for a high note.
Dinner is served.
Cecily.
Might I have a buttonhole first? I never have an appetite unless I have a buttonhole first.
Mr. Worthing.
Marichal Nien. No. I'd sooner have a pink rose.
Why?
Because you are like a pink rose, Cousin Cecily.
I don't think it could be right for you to talk to me like that. Miss Prism never says such things to me.
Then Miss Prism is a short-sighted old lady. You are the prettiest girl I ever saw.
Worthing comes in.
You see, Uncle Jack, there is some good in everyone. Ernest has just been telling me about his poor invalid friend whom he goes to visit so often.
Oh, he's been talking about poor Mr. Bunbury, isn't he?
And surely there must be much good in one who is kind to an invalid and leaves the pleasures of London to sit by a bed of pain.
Cecily saunters off. Under cover of darkness, someone takes fish from the lake as Worthing reads in bed. He looks down a page which includes a picture of an elderly man with a young baby. Stuck at the bottom of the page is a train ticket from Victoria to Worthing. At the corner of the photograph is a handbag. In flashback, he remembers being carried inside the bag. His mind starts to race as he recalls the moment the bag was shut. The next morning, he cracks the top of a hard-boiled egg. He puts on his reading glasses as the butler puts some post at his side.
Morning, sir.
Morning.
He smells the lavender-coloured envelope, then opens it with a letter knife. He sits back in his chair and starts to read.
Dear Ernest, how desperately I have missed you. It seems an age since I last saw you, and our separation is now proving an intolerable strain.
In flashback, Gwendolyn is in an oriental tattoo parlour.
The feelings you have aroused within me are at once delightful and exquisitely painful. My dearest, darling Ernest, it is your very name that inspires me now to take my future in my hands, burnt, as it were, into my very being. And so it is I have resolved to flee these prison walls and make my way directly to your side, to my one and only...
Ernest!
Algy's in the corridor.
Algy!
Worthing strides towards him.
Algy!
Ernest!
Algy turns to him.
Ah, good morning, my dear fellow.
We have to talk. You have to leave.
Leave. How can we talk?
We cannot both be called Ernest.
I don't believe we are, Brother Jack.
Now, Miss Prism and Cecily are on a punt. Algy's standing on the back, pushing them along with a long wooden pole.
Du lobst. Er-C-S. Lobt.
Miss Prism slowly nods off. Algy looks down at Cecily.
I hope, Cecily, I shall not offend you if I state quite openly and frankly that you seem to me to be in every way the visible personification of absolute perfection.
I think your frankness does you great credit, Ernest. If you will allow me, I will copy your remarks into my diary.
Do you keep a diary? I give anything to see it, may I?
Oh, no. You see, it is simply a very young girl's record of thoughts and impressions. But pray, Ernest, I delight in taking down from dictation. You can go on. Don't cough, Ernest.
When one is dictating, one should speak fluently and not cough.
He leans over the back of her chair, manoeuvring his mouth close to her ear.
Ever since I first looked upon your wondrous and incomparable beauty, I have dared to love you. Wildly, wildly, passionately, devotedly, hopelessly.
I beg your pardon, sir. There are two gentlemen wishing to see you.
Gwendolyn's in a car, her recently tattooed backside feeling every bump and jolt. Algy and Cecily meet the new visitors.
Mr. Ernest Worthing?
Yes?
Of B4, the Albany?
Yes, that is my address.
I am very sorry, sir, but I have a writ of attachment against you at the suit of the Savoy Hotel Company Limited for £762.14.
What perfect nonsense. I never dine at the Savoy at my own expense.
In the interests of our clients, we had no option but to take out an order for committal of your person.
Committal? Of my person?
For 6 months.
Oh, for 6 months?
No doubt you'll prefer to pay the bill.
Pay it? How on earth am I going to do that? No gentleman ever has any money.
In my experience, it is usually relations who pay.
Oh, quite right. Brother Jack?
Worthing opens the folder containing the bill.
£762.14 and tuppence. Since last October. I'm bound to say I never saw such reckless extravagance in all my life.
My dear fellow, how ridiculous you are. You have your debts and I have mine. You know quite well this bill is really yours.
Mine?
Yes, and you know it.
Mr. Worthing, if this is another jest, it is most out of place.
It is not.
It is gross effrontery. Just what I expected from him.
And it is ingratitude. I didn't expect that.
Next thing you know, he'll be denying his Ernest Worthing in the first place.
I'm sorry to disturb this pleasant family meeting, but time presses. We have to be at Holloway not later than 4 o'clock, otherwise it is difficult to obtain admission. The rules are very strict.
Holloway? Get off me!
It is at Holloway that detentions of this character are made always.
I will not be imprisoned in the suburbs for having dined in the West End! Jack!
I agree to settle my brother's accounts. On the condition that he makes his way without delay to the bedside of the poor bedridden Bunbury, whose health, I have recently been informed, is rapidly declining. Well, Ernest?
Later, Algy goes out to a carriage waiting on the drive. He looks out across the lawn and sees Cecily studying with Miss Prism. He turns and spots Worthing waving cheerily goodbye from an upstairs window. As Gwendolyn drives along, a couple on a bicycle overtake her. Algy's gone over to Miss Prism and Cecily.
Sensible au Merlin. Bien de la ville.
Mr. Worthing, I would ask you not to interrupt Miss Cardew's studies.
Miss Prism. I almost forgot to mention that Dr. Chasuble is expecting you in the vestry.
In the vestry? Dr. Chasuble?
Expecting you, yes.
That sounds serious. I do not think it would be right to keep him waiting, Cecily.
It would be very, very wrong. The vestry is, I am told, excessively damp.
Miss Prism hurries off towards the house and Algy takes her seat.
This parting, Miss Cardew, is very painful.
But I suppose you cannot desert poor Mr. Bunbury in his hour of need.
I don't care about Bunbury anymore. I don't seem to care about anything anymore. I only care for you. I love you, Cecily.
He looks at her earnestly.
Will you marry me, Cecily, will you?
Of course. Why, we have been engaged for the last 3 months.
For the last 3 months?
Yes, it will be exactly 3 months on Thursday.
Darling.
He chases after her.
So, when was the engagement actually settled?
On the 14th of February last. After a long struggle with myself, I accepted you under this dear old tree here. Oh. And this is the box in which I keep all your dear letters.
my letters. But my own sweet Cecily, I have never written you any letters.
You need hardly remind me of that, Ernest. I remember only too well that I was forced to write your letters for you. I wrote always 3 times a week and sometimes oftener.
Do let me look at them.
Oh, no. I couldn't possibly. They would make you far too conceited. The 3 you wrote me after I had broken off the engagement are so beautiful and so badly spelled. Even now, I can hardly read them without crying a little.
Was our engagement ever broken off?
Yes, of course it was.
What?
On the 22nd of last March. You can see the entry if you like. Today, I broke off my engagement with Ernest. The weather still continues charming.
Why on earth did you break it off? What had I done? I had done nothing at all. Cecily, I'm very much hurt indeed to hear you broke it off. Particularly when the weather was so charming.
Well, it would hardly have been a really serious engagement if I hadn't broken it off at least once, Ernest. But I forgave you before the week was out.
Oh, you're a perfect angel.
You dear romantic boy.
He showers her with tender kisses. In her fantasy, musicians surround her as she gently strokes Algy's hair, her knight in shining armor. Algy lifts his head a little.
You know, I never really thought of myself as a marrying kind until now. You mustn't break it off again, Cecily.
Well, I don't think I could break it off, now that I've actually met you. Besides, of course, there is the question of your name.
Yes, of course.
You mustn't laugh at me, darling, but it has always been a girlish dream of mine to love someone whose name is Ernest. There's something in that name. It seems to inspire absolute confidence.
My own dear child, do you mean to say you couldn't love me if I had another name?
But what name?
Well, Algy, for instance.
I might respect you, Ernest. I might admire your character. But I fear that I would never be able to give you my undivided attention.
They kiss, but are interrupted by Merriman.
The dog cart is ready for you, son.
And now you must go, my love, for sooner than shall you return.
Merriman smiles at Cecily, then walks away with Algy.
What a charming boy. I like his hair so much.
Miss Prism opens the curtains in the vestry and finds the doctor poring over some paintings.
You wanted to see me, Dr. Chasuble.
He quickly hides the pictures.
I didn't.
Oh. You didn't? Oh. I'm sorry, but merely for the purposes of clarification. When you said you didn't, did you mean you didn't say you wanted to see me? Or that you didn't in fact want to see me?
Isn't language a curious thing? Will you excuse me? I have a double baptism this afternoon and I have to, top up the font.
The doctor goes into the next room. Miss Prim shuffles over to his artist's portfolio and opens it up. Inside, she finds a finely drawn pencil sketching of herself. Beneath it is a portrait, also of her, drawn in pastels.
Bless you.
Merriman.
Hey, Miss Fairfax has called to see Mr. Worthing. On very important business, Miss Fairfax states.
Mr. Worthing is sure to be up soon, Merriman, so kindly bring some tea.
Yes, Miss.
Gwendolyn walks towards Cecily with a smile.
Miss Cardew.
Thank you. Miss Fairfax, pray let me introduce myself to you. My name is Cecily Cardew.
Cecily Cardew. What a very sweet name. Something tells me we're going to be great friends. I like you already more than I can say, and my first impressions of people are never wrong.
Later, Gwendolyn lights a cigarette for Cecily.
Here on a short visit, I suppose.
Oh, no, I live here.
Really? Your mother, no doubt, or some
female relative of advanced years resides here also.
Oh, no, I have no mother, nor, in fact, any relations.
Indeed?
My dear guardian has the arduous task of looking after me.
Your guardian?
Yes, I'm Mr. Worthing's ward.
Oh. It is strange, he never mentioned it. How secretive of him. He grows more interesting hourly. But I am bound to state that now that I know you are Mr. Worthing's ward, I cannot help expressing a wish that you were, well, just a little bit older than you seem to be, and not quite so very alluring in appearance. In fact, if I may speak candidly...
Pray do. I think whenever one has anything unpleasant to say, one should always be quite candid.
Yes. Well, to speak with perfect candor, Cecily, I wish you were fully 42 and more than usually plain for your age. Ernest has a strong, upright nature. He's the very soul of truth and honor.
I think Jack, for instance, a charming name.
Oh, but it is not Mr. Ernest Worthing who's my guardian. It is his brother, his elder brother.
That accounts for it. Cecily, you've lifted a load from my mind. I was growing almost anxious. Of course, you're quite sure it's not Mr. Ernest Worthing who is your guardian.
Quite sure. In fact, I am going to be his.
I beg your pardon?
Mr. Ernest Worthing and I are engaged to be married.
Oh. My darling, Cecily, I think there must be some slight error. Mr. Ernest Worthing is engaged to me. The announcement will appear in the Morning Post on Saturday at the latest.
I'm afraid you must be under some misconception. Ernest proposed to me exactly 10 minutes ago.
Oh, it's very curious, for he asked me to be his wife yesterday afternoon at 5:30. If you would care to verify the incident, pray do so. I never travel without my diary. One should always have something sensational to read in the train. I'm so sorry, dear Cecily, but I'm afraid I have the prior claim.
Algy's wearing a grumpy expression as he rides on the roof of the ramshackle carriage, surrounded by luggage. It passes under a tree and continues rolling down the muddy road. Algy drops down from the tree, the carriage driver seemingly oblivious to his disembarkation.
May I offer you some tea, Miss Fairfax?
Thank you, Miss Carter.
Sugar?
No, thank you. Sugar is not fashionable anymore.
With Gwendolyn looking the other way, Cecily drops 2 sugar lumps into her tea. She then drops 1 into her own. She passes the first cup to Merriman, who takes it to Gwendolyn.
Cake or bread and butter?
Bread and butter, please. Cake is rarely seen in the best houses nowadays.
Merriman's given a piece of fruitcake by Cecily and carries it round to Gwendolyn.
The moment I saw you, I distrusted you. I felt that you were false and deceitful.
It seems to me, Miss Fairfax, that I am trespassing on your valuable time. No doubt you have many other calls of a similar character to make in the neighbourhood. Ernest!
It's Algy.
You're back so soon.
My own love.
A moment, Ernest. May I ask you, are you engaged to be married to this young lady?
What young lady? Good heavens, Gwendolyn.
Yes, to good heavens, Gwendolyn.
Of course not. What put such an idea into your pretty little head?
Thank you. You may.
I thought there must be some slight error, Miss Cardew. The gentleman who is now embracing you is my cousin, Mr. Algernon Moncrief.
Algernon? Moncrief?
Yes.
Algy.
Oh. Here is Ernest.
It's Worthing.
Oh, my own Ernest.
Gwendolyn, my darling. Oh.
I knew there must be some misunderstanding, Miss Fairfax. The gentleman whose arm is at present round your waist is my guardian, Mr. John Worthing.
I beg your pardon?
This is Uncle Jack.
Jack?
Gwendolyn remembers the Ernest tattoo on her behind.
I cannot deny it.
Is your name really John?
I could deny it if I liked. I could deny anything if I liked, but it certainly is John. It has been John for years.
A gross deception has been practiced on both of
us. My poor wounded Cecily.
My sweet wronged Gwendolyn. Oh.
You will call me sister, will you not?
Of course.
Let us go into the house, sister. They will hardly venture to come after us there.
No, men are so cowardly, aren't they?
Algy chomps on a muffin as the women walk off, arm in arm.
Now, you can sit there calmly eating muffins when we're in this horrible trouble. I can't make out. You seem to me to be perfectly heartless.
I can hardly eat muffins in an agitated manner, can I? Butter will probably get on my cuffs.
I say it's perfectly heartless you're eating muffins at all under the circumstances.
When I'm in trouble, eating is my only consolation. Indeed, when I'm in really great trouble, as anyone who knows me intimately will tell you, I refuse everything except food and drink. At the present moment, I am eating muffins because I am unhappy. Besides, I'm particularly fond of muffins.
There's no reason why you should eat them all in that greedy way.
Worthing takes a muffin.
Would you like some tea cake? I don't like tea cake.
Good heavens, I suppose a man may eat his own muffins and his own god.
They seem to be eating muffins.
But you just said it was perfectly heartless to eat muffins.
I said it was perfectly heartless of you under the circumstances. It is a very different thing.
That may be, but the muffins are the same.
No! Oh. 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 Oh, I certainly don't break your chances as my ward, Algernon.
I don't think there's much likelihood of you, Jack, and Miss Fairfax being united.
Gwendolyn puts a pair of binoculars to her eyes and watches the two men fighting over the muffins. They sense somebody's watching and separate. Later, Worthing's gone to see the doctor.
But is there any particular infant in whom you are interested, Mr. Worthing?
The fact is, dear doctor, I would like to be christened myself. This afternoon, if you have nothing better to do.
Surely, Mr. Worthing, you've been christened already.
I don't remember anything about it. Of course, I don't know if the thing would bother you in any way, or if you think that I'm a little too old now.
No, not at all, not at all, not at all. The sprinkling and indeed immersion of adults is a perfectly canonical practice. What hour would you wish the ceremony performed?
I might trot round at about 6 o'clock, if that would suit you.
Oh, perfectly, perfectly.
Thank you.
Now it's Algy walking out of the chapel.
We cannot both be christened, Ernest. It's absurd.
I have a perfect right to be christened if I like.
But you've been christened already.
Yes, but I haven't been christened for years.
Yes, but you've been christened. That is the important thing.
Quite so. Sir, I know my constitution can stand it. If you're not quite sure about your ever having been christened, I must say I think it rather dangerous you're venturing on it now.
Nonsense, you're always talking nonsense. No!
The men fight over two bunches of flowers. As they scuffle, Gwendolyn and Cecily come racing past on horseback, splattering their fiancés with mud. Back at the house, servants help manoeuvre a piano out onto the lawn so Algy and Worthing can serenade Cecily and Gwendolyn.
Let us preserve a dignified silence.
Certainly, it's the only thing to do now.
The western wind is blowing fair
across the dark Aegean Sea, and at the secret marble stair, my Tyrian galley waits for thee. Come down, the purple sail is spread. The watchman sleeps within the town.
This dignified silence seems to produce an unpleasant effect.
A most distasteful one.
Oh, lady mine, come down.
Come down. Lady, come down.
The two women go inside. Now, as Worthing plays the guitar, servants help Algy take the piano into the house.
She will not come, I know her well. A lover's vow, she hath no care. A little good a man can tell. Of one so cruel and so fair. True love is but a woman's toy. They never know the lover's pain. And I who loved as loves a boy must love in vain. Must love in vain.
Lady, come
The two women start walking down the stairs together. They stop halfway and confer. They continue their way down to the bottom of the staircase.
You will not be the first to speak.
Certainly not.
Mr. Worthing, I have something very particular to ask you. Much depends on your reply.
Gwendolyn, your common sense is invaluable. Mr. Moncrief, kindly answer me the following question. Why did you pretend to be my guardian's brother?
In order that I might have an opportunity of meeting you.
Well, that certainly seems a satisfactory explanation, does it not?
Yes, dear, if you can believe him.
I don't, but that doesn't affect the wonderful beauty of his answer.
True, in matters of grave importance, style, not sincerity, is the vital thing. Mr. Worthing, what possible explanation can you offer me for pretending to have a brother? Was it in order that you might have an opportunity of coming up to town to see me as often as possible?
Can you doubt it, Miss Fairfax?
I have the gravest doubts on the subject. But I intend to crush them. Their explanations appear to be quite satisfactory. Especially Mr. Worthing's. That seems to me to have the stamp of truth upon it.
I am more than content with what Mr. Moncrief said. His voice alone seemed to inspire absolute credulity.
Then you think we should forgive them?
Yes. I mean, no.
True, there are principles at stake that one cannot surrender.
They hurry off hand in hand to another room, and the men follow them.
Your Christian names are still an insuperable barrier. That is all.
My Christian names?
Was that all?
But we're going to be christened this afternoon.
For my sake, you're prepared to do this terrible thing.
I am.
To please me, you're ready to face this fearful ordeal.
I am.
Where questions of self-sacrifice are concerned, men are infinitely beyond us.
We are.
Darling.
Darling.
The doors swing open.
Lady Bracknell.
Gwendolyn! What does this mean?
Merely that I am engaged to be married to Mr. Worthing, Mama.
Come here. Sit down. Sit down immediately.
After a moment, Gwendolyn obeys.
Of course, you will clearly understand, sir, that all communication between yourself and my daughter must cease immediately from this moment. On this point, as indeed on all points, I am firm.
I am engaged to be married to Gwendolyn, Lady Bracknell.
You are nothing of the kind, sir. And now, as regards Algy. Algy?
Yes, Aunt Augusta.
May I ask if it is in this house that your invalid friend Mr. Bunbury resides?
No, Bunbury doesn't live here. Bunbury's somewhere else at present. In fact, Bunbury is dead.
Dead?
Dead.
When did Mr. Bunbury die? His death must have been extremely sudden.
Bunbury died this afternoon.
What did he die of?
Bunbury? It was quite exploded.
Exploded? Was he the victim of some revolutionary outrage? I was not aware that Mr. Bunbury was interested in social legislation.
My dear Aunt Augusta, I mean, he was found out. The doctors found out that Bunbury could not live. That is what I mean. So Bunbury died.
He seems to have had great confidence in the opinion of his physicians. I'm glad, however, that he made up his mind at the last to some definite course of action and acted under proper medical advice. And now that we have finally got rid of this Mr. Bunbury, may I ask, Mr. Worthing, who is that young person whose hand my nephew Algernon is now holding in what seems to me to be a peculiarly unnecessary manner?
That lady is Miss Cecily Cardew, my ward.
Yes, I am engaged to be married to Cecily, Aunt Augusta.
I beg your pardon?
Mr. Moncrief and I are engaged to be married, Lady Bracknell.
I do not know whether there's anything peculiarly exciting about the air of this particular part of Hertfordshire. But the number of engagements that go on seem to me to be considerably above the proper average that statistics have laid down for our guidance. Mr. Worthing, is Miss Cardew at all connected with any of the larger railway stations in London? I merely desire information. Until recently, I was not aware that there were any families or persons whose origin was a terminus. Gwendolyn, the time approaches for our departure. We have not a moment to lose. As a matter of form, Mr. Worthing, I'd better ask if Miss Cardew has any little fortune.
Oh, about £130 in the funds, that is all.
Goodbye.
Goodbye, Lady Bracknell. So pleased to have seen you.
A moment, Mr. Worthing. £130,000. And in the funds. Miss Cardew seems to me to be a most attractive young lady now that I look at her. Come over here, dear. The chin a little higher, dear. Style largely depends on the way the chin is worn. They're worn very high just at present. Algie?
Yes, Aunt Augusta.
There are distinct social possibilities in Miss Cardew's profile.
Cecily is the sweetest, dearest, prettiest girl in the whole world, and I don't give tuppence for her social possibilities.
Never speak disrespectfully of society, Algernon. Only people who can't get into it do that. Dear child, you know, of course, that Algie has nothing but his debts to depend upon. But I do not approve of mercenary marriages. Indeed, when I married Lord Bracknell, I had no fortune of any kind.
In flashback, a young Lady Bracknell is a dancing girl in a music hall. She blows a kiss to a man in the audience and later tells him she's pregnant.
But I never dreamed for a moment of allowing that to stand in my way. Well, I suppose I must give my consent.
Thank you, Aunt Augusta.
I beg your pardon for interrupting you, Lady Bracknell, but I am Miss Cardew's guardian. She cannot marry without my consent until she comes of age. And that consent I absolutely decline to give.
Upon what grounds, may I ask?
I suspect him of being untruthful.
Untruthful? My nephew, Algie?
I fear there can be no possible doubt about the matter.
They walk out onto the drive.
During my temporary absence in London on an important question of romance, he obtained admission to my house by means of the false pretense of being my brother. He then proceeded to win over the affections of my only ward when his own intentions, I'm utterly convinced, were purely financial. Tonight, if you dare. He subsequently stayed to tea and devoured every single muffin. And what makes his behaviour all the more heartless is that he was perfectly aware from the start that I have no brother, that I never had a brother, and that I don't intend to have a brother, not even of any kind.
Uncle Jack, please.
Oh, my word, Jack.
Come here, sweet child. How old are you, dear?
18, Aunt Augusta.
18? Well, it will not be long before you are of age and free from the restraints of your guardian.
According to the terms of her grandfather's will, she does not come legally of age until she is 35.
That does not seem to me to be a grave objection. 35 is a very attractive age. London society is full of women of the very highest birth who have, of their own free choice, remained 35 for years.
Algie, could you wait for me till I was 35?
Of course I could. You know I could.
Yes, I felt it instinctively. But I couldn't wait all that time.
And what is to be done, Cecily?
I don't know, Mr. Moncrief.
My dear Mr. Worthing, as Miss Cardew states quite positively that she cannot wait until she is 35, a remark which I am bound to say seems to me to show a somewhat impatient nature, I would beg you to reconsider your decision.
No, my dear Lady Bracknell, the matter is entirely in your own hands. The moment you consent to my marriage with Gwendolyn, I will most gladly allow your nephew to form an alliance with my ward.
You must be aware that what you propose is out of the question.
And a passionate celibacy is all any of us can look forward to.
Come, dear. We've already missed 5, if not 6 trains. To miss any more might expose us to comment on the platform.
Everything is quite ready for the christenings.
The christening, sir? Is not that somewhat premature?
But both of these gentlemen have expressed a desire for immediate baptism.
At their age? The idea is grotesque and irreligious. Algie, I forbid you to be baptized. I will not hear of such excesses.
I'm sorry to interrupt, Dr. Chasuble.
Yes, yes.
Miss Prism has asked me to tell you. She's waiting for you in the vestry. Indeed, I believe she's been waiting for some time.
Miss Prism, in the vestry.
Waiting for you.
Yes. Miss Prism. Did I hear you mention a Miss Prism?
Yes, madam. I'm on my...
Bless you.
Yes, madam, I'm on my way to join her.
Is this Miss Prism a female of repellent aspect, remotely connected with education?
She is the most cultivated of ladies, and the picture of respectability.
It is obviously the same person. Dr. Chasuble, take me to the vestry at once.
A flushed doctor arrives at the vestry.
I've been expecting you, dear doctor.
Prism!
Miss Prism runs away from Lady Bracknell.
Prism!
She runs out the back entrance, but Lady Bracknell and the others cut her off. Miss Prism collapses in a heap on the grass. Later, Worthing wakes her by wafting smelling salts under her nose.
"34 years ago, Prism, you left Lord Bracknell's house, number 104 Upper Grosvenor Street, in charge of a perambulator that contained a baby of the male sex. You never returned. A few weeks later, through the elaborate investigations of the Metropolitan Police, the perambulator was discovered at midnight, standing by itself in a remote corner of Bayswater. It contained the manuscript of a 3-volume novel of more than usually revolting sentimentality. But the baby was not there. Prism, where is that baby?
Lady Bracknell, I admit with shame that I do not know. The plain facts of the case are these. On the morning of the day in question, a day that is forever branded on my memory, I prepared, as usual, to take the baby out in its perambulator. I had also with me a somewhat old but capacious handbag in which I had intended to place the manuscript of a work of fiction that I had written during my few unoccupied hours. In a moment of mental abstraction for which I never can forgive myself, I deposited the manuscript in the bassinet and placed the baby in the handbag.
But where did you deposit the handbag?
Do not ask me, Mr. Worthing.
Miss Prism, this is a matter of no small importance to me. I insist on knowing where you deposited the handbag that contained that infant.
I left it in the cloakroom of one of the larger railway stations in London.
What railway station?
Victoria. The Brighton line.
Worthing runs into the house, charges up the stairs and into a storeroom. Moments later, he comes racing back down, carrying a leather handbag.
Uncle Jack seems strangely agitated.
Holding it in both hands, he presents it to Miss Prism.
Is this the handbag, Miss Prism?
She takes it from him.
Examine it carefully before you speak. The happiness of more than one life depends on your answer.
The bag is undoubtedly mine. I am delighted to have it so unexpectedly restored to me. It has been a great inconvenience being without it all these years.
Miss Prism, more is restored to you than this handbag. I was the baby you placed in it.
You?
Yes. Mother!
Oh, Mr. Worthing, I am unmarried.
Unmarried? I cannot deny that is a serious blow. But after all, who has the right to cast a stone against one who has suffered? Cannot repentance wipe out an act of folly? Mother, I forgive you.
No, Mr. Worthing. There is some error. There is the lady who can tell you who you really are.
She points at Lady Bracknell.
Lady Bracknell, I hate to seem inquisitive, but would you kindly inform me who I am?
You are the son of my poor sister, Mrs. Moncrief, and consequently Algy's younger brother.
Algy gets to his feet.
Algy's younger brother.
The two men stare at one another. Algy starts to back away slightly as his brother steps towards him. They remember their recent fights, but also times of great friendship. Algy has a flashback of opening a handbag and finding a baby inside.
So, I have a brother after all?
Yes.
I knew I had a brother! Okay. Always said I had a brother. Cecily, how could you ever have doubted that I had a brother? Dr. Chasuble, my unfortunate... Miss Prism, my unfortunate brother. Gwendolyn, my unfortunate brother. Lady Bracknell, my brother.
Algy pretends to faint, but then gets up and hugs his brother. They leap around the room in a tight embrace.
Under these strange and unforeseen circumstances, Mr. Moncrief, you may kiss your Aunt Augusta.
He plants a big wet kiss on her cheek.
Mr. Moncrief, after all that has occurred, and any inconvenience I may have caused you in your infancy, I feel it is my duty to resign my position in this household.
Miss Prism, the suggestion is absurd. I won't hear of it.
Sir, it is my duty to leave. I have really nothing more to teach, dear Cecily. In the very difficult accomplishment of getting married, I fear my sweet and clever pupil has far outstripped her teacher.
No. Miss Prism kisses Cecily tenderly on the cheek. She turns and starts to walk away, carrying the handbag.
A moment, Miss Prism.
Dr. Chasuble.
I come to the conclusion that the primitive church is in error on certain points on the question of matrimony. Corrupt readings seem to have crept into the text. In consequence, I beg to solicit the honor of your hand.
Frederick.
Letitia. My dear Cecily.
Dearest Algernon.
My own Gwendolyn.
My own. But wait, who are you? I mean, what is your Christian name, Mr. Moncrief? Now you have become someone else.
Good heavens, I've quite forgotten that point. The question had better be cleared up at once. Aunt Augusta, a moment. At the time when Miss Prism left me in the handbag, had I been christened already?
Yes, I think you were christened after your father.
I see. Then what was my father's Christian name?
I cannot at the present moment recall what the general's name was. I've no doubt he had one.
Algy, can't you recollect what our father's Christian name was?
My dear fellow, we were hardly on speaking terms. He died when I was only three.
His name would appear on the army lists of the period, I suppose, Aunt Augusta.
The general was essentially a man of peace, except in his domestic life. But no doubt his name would appear on any military directory.
He goes to the bookshelves.
Army lists of the last 40 years, it is. These delightful records should have been my constant study. Lieutenants, captains, colonels, colonels, generals. M. Max Bohm, Magley, Markby, Migsby, Mobbs, Moncrief. Lieutenant, 1860, Christian names.
He looks up from the book and snaps it closed in his hand before climbing down the library ladder.
I always told you, Gwendolyn, that my name was Ernest, didn't I? Well, it is Ernest, after all. I mean, it naturally is Ernest.
My own Ernest, I felt from the first that you could have no other name.
Lady Bracknell checks the spine of the book and then watches Ernest and Gwendolyn kissing. The musicians appear as rose petals flutter down on Ernest and Gwendolyn. Algy's in a suit of armour, standing next to Cecily, who's sitting on a white steed. Looking like Roman nobles, Miss Prism stares lovingly at the Doctor. Lady Bracknell checks the entry in the military records book. Next to the surname Moncrief is the first name John.
My nephew, you seem to be displaying signs of triviality.
On the contrary, Aunt Augusta. I've now realised for the first time in my life the vital importance of being earnest.
She slowly breaks into a smile and tosses the book over her shoulder. It flies through the air and Merriman catches it. The three couples look lovingly at one another.
Across the dark Aegean Sea, and at the secret marble stair, my Tyrian galley waits for thee. Come down the purple sailor spread, the watchman sleeps within the town. Oh, leave thy lily-flowered bed, oh, lady mine, come down, come down. Lady, come down, come down, lady, come down, oh, lady, come down.